Chapter 8. A moment to the extravagance of imagining that Mrs. Gresham, whom he disliked, had organized the reading in the hope of making him betray himself, for he was already sure that Gresham had divined his share in the transaction. The attempt to keep a smooth surface on this inner tumult was as endless and unavailing as efforts made in a nightmare. He lost all sense of what he was saying to his neighbors, and once, when he looked up, his wife's glance struck him cold. She sat nearly opposite him, at Flamel's side, and it appeared to Glenard that they had built about themselves one of those airy barriers of talk behind which two people can say what they please. While the reading was discussed, they were silent. Their silence seemed to Glenard almost cynical. It stripped the last disguise from their complicity. A throb of anger rose in him, but suddenly it fell, and he felt, with a curious sense of relief, that at bottom he no longer cared whether Flamel had told his wife or not. The assumption that Flamel knew about the letters had become a fact to Glenard, and it now seemed to him better that Alixa should know too. He was frightened at first by the discovery of his own indifference. The last barriers of his will seemed to be breaking down before a flood of moral lassitude. How could he continue to play his part, to keep his front to the enemy, with this poison of indifference stealing through his veins? He tried to brace himself with the remembrance of his wife's scorn. He had not forgotten the note on which their conversation had closed. If he had ever wondered how she would receive the truth, he wondered no longer she would despise him. But this lent a new insidiousness to his temptation, since her contempt would be a refuge from his own. He said to himself that, since he no longer cared for the consequences, he could at least acquit himself of speaking in self-defense. What he wanted now was not immunity but castigation. His wife's indignation might still reconcile him to himself. Therein lay his one hope of regeneration. Her scorn was the moral antiseptic that he needed, her comprehension the one balm that could heal him. When they left the dinner, he was so afraid of speaking that he let her drive home alone and went to the club with Flamel. He rose next morning with the resolve to know what Alixa thought of him. It was not anchoring in a haven, but lying to in a storm. He felt the need of a temporary lull in the turmoil of his sensations. He came home late, for they were dining alone, and he knew that they would have the evening together. When he followed her to the drawing room after dinner, he thought himself on the point of speaking, but as she handed him his coffee, he said, involuntarily, "I shall have to carry this off to the study. I've got a lot of work tonight." Alone in the study, he cursed his cowardice. What was it that had withheld him? A certain bright unapproachableness seemed to keep him at arm's length. She was not the kind of woman whose compassion could be circumvented. There was no chance of slipping past the outposts. He would never take her by surprise. Well, why not face her, then? What he shrank from could be no worse than what he was enduring. He had pushed back his chair and turned to go upstairs when a new expedient presented itself. What if, instead of telling her, he were to let her find out for herself, and watch the effect of the discovery before speaking? In this way he made over to chance the burden of the revelation. The idea had been suggested by the sight of the formula enclosing the publisher's check. He had deposited the money, but the notice accompanying it dropped from his note case as he cleared his table for work. It was the formula usual in such cases, and revealed clearly enough that he was the recipient of a royalty on Margaret Aubyn's letters. It would be impossible for Alixa to read it without understanding at once that the letters had been written to him, and that he had sold them. He sat downstairs till he heard a ring for the parlor maid to put out the lights. Then he went up to the drawing room with a bundle of papers in his hand. Alixa was just rising from her seat, and the lamplight fell on the deep roll of hair that overhung her brow like the eaves of a temple. Her face had often the high secluded look of a shrine, and it was this touch of awe in her beauty that now made him feel himself on the brink of sacrilege. Lest the feeling should dominate him, he spoke at once. I've brought you a piece of work, a lot of old bills and things that I want you to sort for me. Some are not worth keeping, but you'll be able to judge of that. There may be a letter or two among them, nothing of much account, but I don't like to throw away a whole lot without having them looked over, and I haven't time to do it myself. He held out the papers and she took them with a smile that seemed to recognize in the service he asked the tacit intention of making amends for the incident of the previous day. Are you sure I shall know which to keep? Oh, quite sure, he answered, easily, and besides, none are of much importance. The next morning he invented an excuse for leaving the house without seeing her, and when he returned, just before dinner, he found a visitor's hat and stick in the hall. The visitor was Flamel, who was in the act of taking leave. He had risen, but Alixa remained seated, and their attitude gave the impression of a colloquy that had prolonged itself beyond the limits of speech. Both turned a surprised eye on Glenard, and he had the sense of walking into a room grown suddenly empty, as though their thoughts were conspirators dispersed by his approach. He felt the clutch of his old fear. What if his wife had already sorted the papers, and had told Flamel of her discovery? Well, it was no news to Flamel that Glenard was in receipt of a royalty on the Uban letters. A sudden resolve to know the worst made him lift his eyes to his wife as the door closed on Flamel. But Alixa had risen also, and bending over her writing table, with her back to Glenard, was beginning to speak precipitately. I'm dining out tonight, you don't mind my deserting you? Julia Armiger sent me word just now that she had an extra ticket for the last Ambrose concert. She told me to say how sorry she was that she hadn't too, but I knew you wouldn't be sorry. She ended with a laugh that had the effect of being a straight echo of Mrs. Armiger's. And before Glenard could speak, he had added, with her hand on the door, Mr. Flamel stayed so late that I've hardly time to dress. The concert begins ridiculously early, and Julia dines at 7:30. Glenard stood alone in the empty room that seemed somehow full of an ironical consciousness of what was happening. He hates me, he murmured. He hates me. The next day was Sunday, and Glenard purposely lingered late in his room. When he came downstairs, his wife was already seated at the breakfast table. She lifted her usual smile to his entrance, and they took shelter in the nearest topic, like wayfarers overtaken by a storm. While he listened to her account of the concert, he began to think that, after all, he had not yet sorted the papers, and that her agitation of the previous day must be ascribed to another cause, in which perhaps he had but an indirect concern. He wondered it had never before occurred to him that Flamel was the kind of man who might very well please a woman at his own expense, without need of fortuitous assistance. If this possibility cleared the outlook, it did not brighten it. Glenard merely felt himself left alone with his baseness. Alixa left the breakfast table before him, and when he went up to the drawing room, he found her dressed to go out. Aren't you a little early for church? He asked. She replied that, on the way there, she meant to stop a moment at her mother's, and while she drew on her gloves, he fumbled among the knick-knacks on the mantelpiece for a match to light a cigarette. Well, goodbye, she said, turning to go, and from the threshold she added, colon, by the way, I've sorted the papers you gave me. Those that I thought you would like to keep are on your study table. She went downstairs, and he heard the door close behind her. As he had sorted the papers, she knew, then she must know, and she had made no sign. Glenard, he hardly knew how, found himself once more in the study. On the table lay the packet he had given her. It was much smaller, as he had evidently gone over the papers with care, destroying the greater number. He loosened the elastic band and spread the remaining envelopes on his desk. The publisher's notice was among them. X, his wife knew, and she made no sign. Glenard found himself in the case of the seafarer who, closing his eyes at nightfall on a scene he thinks to put leaks behind him before day, wakes to a porthole framing the same patch of shore. from the kind of exaltation to which his resolve had lifted him, he dropped to an unreasoning apathy. His impulse of confession had acted as a drug to self-reproach. He had tried to shift a portion of his burden to his wife's shoulders, and now that as he had tacitly refused to carry it, he felt the load too heavy to be taken up again. A fortunate interval of hard work brought respite from this phase of sterile misery. He went west to argue an important case, won it, and came back to fresh preoccupations. His own affairs were thriving enough to engross him in the pauses of his professional work, and for over 2 months he had little time to look himself in the face. Not unnaturally, for he was as yet unskilled in the subtleties of introspection, he mistook his temporary insensibility for a gradual revival of moral health. He told himself that he was recovering his sense of proportion, getting to see things in their true light, and if he now thought of his rash appeal to his wife's sympathy, it was as an act of folly from the consequences, of which he had been saved by the providence that watches over madmen. He had little leisure to observe Alexa, but he concluded that the common sense momentarily denied him had counseled her uncritical acceptance of the inevitable. If such a quality was a poor substitute for the passionate justness that at once seemed to characterize her, he accepted the alternative as a part of that general lowering of the key that seems needful to the maintenance of the matrimonial duet. What woman ever retained her abstract sense of justice where another woman was concerned? Possibly the thought that he had profited by Mrs. Aubyn's tenderness was not wholly disagreeable to his wife. When the pressure of work began to lessen, and he found himself, in the lengthening afternoons, able to reach home somewhat earlier, he noticed that the little drawing room was always full, and that he and his wife seldom had an evening alone together. When he was tired, as often happened, she went out alone. The idea of giving up an engagement to remain with him seemed not to occur to her. As he had shown, as a girl, little fondness for society, nor had she seemed to regret it during the year they had spent in the country. He reflected, however, that he was sharing the common lot of husbands, who proverbially mistake the early ardors of housekeeping for a sign of settled domesticity. Alexa, at any rate, was refuting his theory as inconsiderately as a seedling defeats the gardener's expectations. An undefinable change had come over her. In one sense it was a happy one, since as he had grown, if not handsomer, at least more vivid and expressive, her beauty had become more communicable. It was as though as he had learned the conscious exercise of intuitive attributes, and now used her effects with the discrimination of an artist skilled in values. To a dispassionate critic, as Glenard now rated himself, the art may at times have been a little too obvious. Her attempts at lightness lacked spontaneity, and she sometimes rasped him by laughing like Julia Armiger. But he had enough imagination to perceive that, in respect of the wife's social arts, a husband necessarily sees the wrong side of the tapestry. In this ironical estimate of their relation, Glenard found himself strangely relieved of all concern as to his wife's feelings for Flamel. From an Olympian pinnacle of indifference, he calmly surveyed their inoffensive antics. It was surprising how his cheapening of his wife put him at ease with himself. Far as he and she were from each other, they yet had, in a sense, the tacit nearness of complicity. Yes, they were accomplices. He could no more be jealous of her than she could despise him. The jealousy that would once have seemed a blur on her whiteness now appeared like a tribute to ideals in which he no longer believed. Glenard was little given to exploring the outskirts of literature. He always skipped the iterary notices in the papers, and he had small leisure for the intermittent pleasures of the periodical. He had therefore no notion of the prolonged reverberations which the Aubyn letters had awakened in the precincts of criticism. When the book ceased to be talked about, he supposed that it ceased to be read, and this apparent subsidence of the agitation about it brought the reassuring sense that he had exaggerated its vitality. The conviction, if it did not ease his conscience, at least offered him the relative relief of obscurity. He felt like an offender taken down from the pillory and thrust into the soothing darkness of a cell. But one evening, when Alexa had left him to go to a dance, he chanced to turn over the magazines on her table and the copy of the horoscope, to which he settled down with his cigar, confronted him, on its first page, with a portrait of Margaret Aubin. It was a reproduction of the photograph that had stood so long on his desk. The desiccating air of memory had turned her into the mere abstraction of a woman, and this unexpected evocation seemed to bring her nearer than he had ever been in life. Was it because he understood her better? He looked long into her eyes. Little personal traits reached out to him like caresses, the tired droop of her lids, her quick way of leaning forward as she spoke, the movements of her long expressive hands. All that was feminine in her, the quality he had always missed, stole toward him from her unreproachful gaze, and now that it was too late, life had developed in him the subtler perceptions which could detect it in even this poor semblance of herself. For a moment he found consolation in the thought that, at any cost, they had thus been brought together. Then a flood of shame rushed over him. Face to face with her, he felt himself laid bare to the inmost fold of consciousness. The shame was deep, but it was a renovating anguish. He was like a man whom intolerable pain has roused from the creeping lethargy of death. He rose next morning to as fresh a sense of life, as though his hour of mute communion with Margaret Aubin had been a more exquisite renewal of their earlier meetings. His waking thought was that he must see her again, and as consciousness affirmed itself, he felt an intense fear of losing the sense of her nearness. But she was still close to him. Her presence remained the sole reality in a world of shadows. All through his working hours he was reliving with incredible minuteness every incident. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.